kind of criticisms. I'd love to hear them after the program is over. But now it is my great honor to introduce my good friend Paul Graham from Columbia, South Carolina. My grandmother used to say, or once said, we could have whipped the Yankees with corn stalks. They just wouldn't have fought with corn stalks, right? They wanted to use guns. What the Yankees had, they had industrial power behind them that we were never able to bring to bear. Well, in the modern age, we're now in the age of social media and all that kind of stuff, and we have to adapt to that. And one of the people who has adapted to that is Paul Graham, who started the Shotwell. He and Clyde Wilson have started Shotwell Publishing, using modern technology to be able to produce really good quality material at a very reasonable price. And it's something we can all learn from, and that's one of the reasons we wanted Paul to be here with us today. And I'll now turn it over to Paul Graham.
All right. I like to get the applause up front, you know, just in case. All right. How's everyone? Now, see, speaking after lunch, you know that people are going to start fading. So if your neighbor begins to fade, your job is to nudge them, or else I'm going to make people stand up, and you don't want that. Too late? All right.
Rebel yell and wake them up.
I'll have you rebel yell if that's what it takes. Thank you. All right. Here I go. It seemed like just another day at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, for the Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, Paula Knudsen. Until the phone calls, student visitors, and official, quote, bias and hate reports began to pour in. A truck, a semi-tractor truck to be exact, had somehow breached the invisible line that marked the safe space on campus. And without any apparent regard for the students' feelings, was right there on the construction site at the student center, a truck with a Confederate flag grill cover. I know. Shockwave spread as iPhones, Androids, and other electronic devices lit up across campus and warning fellow students about the hateful display. After receiving the message loud and clear, quote, this is hurtful, unquote, the Vice Chancellor called for action. Executive Director of Facilities, Douglas Pearson, was quickly dispatched to the construction site to get to the bottom of this blatant disregard for the emotional well-being of the young scholars. Pearson spoke with the superintendent, who in turn spoke to the truck driver, who in turn moved his truck without complaint. Among those affected by the truck was physics senior Matthew Drace, who saw the flag on his way to class. This is very inappropriate, said Drace. I think we have a problem with institutional racism at our school, and when we see it at the construction site, at the physical building where students are getting their education, it solidifies that there is a problem with our campus atmosphere, unquote. It apparently never occurred to the future physicists that the truck had nothing to do with the school, or perhaps that the trucker did not view the flag in such terms. In fact, no thought whatsoever seemed been made of the truck driver by anyone at the university, how he was affected, and how their hostility, inhospitality, and general lack of good manners may have affected him. In an email sent to students later that afternoon, Vice Chancellor apologized for, quote, the fear and angst caused by the flag's presence, unquote. She further assured the students that the flag bespangled truck had been removed from campus. So everything was safe again.
Thank God.
Well, there's more. Because a furious storm of confusion rained down upon Indiana University in at Bloomington when a tweet, that's a little thing that people do on the computers, for y'all that don't know, went out on what was otherwise an unremarkable spring evening. A man in white robes had been spotted. It appeared that there was a Klansman on campus. And he was carrying a whip. The first tweet went out. IU students, be careful. There's someone walking around in KKK gear and a whip. It took less than 1 minute for another tweet to go out to the entire campus, which said, quote, there is a man walking around in campus in a KKK hood carrying a whip, and is there nothing you can do to make the students feel safe? Ethan Gill, being mindful of his responsibility as a resident assistant, sent out a Facebook post to the young scholars for whom he was responsible. He was cautious, citing the First Amendment rights of Klansmen. But he urged vigilance. Quote, please, 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 pleaded Gill, be careful out there tonight. Always be with someone. And if you have no dire reason to be out of the building, I would recommend staying indoors if you are alone. If you begin to feel unsafe, please contact me. The feeling of safety was dwindling quickly, and panic had begun to take hold. They tell me this is water. The feeling of safety and take hold. Okay. In an unrelated event on the campus of Bowling Green State University in Ohio, there was another Klan sighting. Unlike the sighting at Indiana University, the hooded miscreant or miscreants were not simply roaming the grounds. They were inside, apparently having a Klan rally in one of the university's laboratories. The student who happened upon the rally quickly took some video and sent it out via Twitter, taking special aim at the university's president, Mary Ellen Mazie. Quote, there has been an active KKK group in Bowling Green, Ohio since 1922. President Mazie, so how does this promote diversity and inclusion? Unquote. President Mazie, sensing the urgency of the matter, quickly dispatched a university contingency to the scene. And after a thorough investigation, the case was cracked. Exercising a restraint that I myself would have found most difficult, if not impossible, the president issued her own tweet in response. Quote, thanks for sharing. We looked into this. We discovered it is a cover on a piece of lab equipment. Alas, no Klansmen on campus, just some lab equipment, some protective covering, and a little student hysteria. But what about Indiana? Glad you asked. Well, I hate to disappoint you all, but there was no Klansmen there either. Sadly, these young scholars were unable to differentiate between a Klansman with a whip, which did not exist, and a Dominican monk in a traditional white robe who was carrying a rosary, which did exist. I got a couple more of these, and then we'll go into the meat of the material. But this is, I'm setting it up. Executives at ESPN apparently worried that the Asian American sportscaster Robert Lee would be mistaken for the former commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, reassigned him from covering the University of Virginia's first football game of the 2017-18 season against William & Mary, despite the fact that the general named Robert Lee had been dead for over a century. The game held at Charlottesville, Virginia, had been the recent scene of a standoff between alt-right and alt-left groups at the Robert E. Lee statue that magically and without provocation erupted into violence. It is not clear who or whom ESPN thought would be confused or upset by sportscaster Lee's presence at the Charlottesville game. That was averted, a big thing averted, I'm sure. Final one. And these are all true, by the way. I just kind of worded them to make them sound funny. A student at Framingham University, located about 20 miles outside of Boston, was traumatized when a Confederate flag sticker was seen on the laptop computer of another student. This, quote, bias incident, unquote, that's what they were calling it, was reported to the school's, and this is a real title too, bias protocol and response team, unquote. Who quickly responded to the complaint. Framingham State's Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer, also a real title, Sean Huddleston, sent out a mass email to the student population explaining the details of the incident and strongly suggesting that those impacted by the incident seek counseling. The bias and protocol response team, said Huddleston, will meet to determine any measure that needs to be done to respond to this incident. Our primary goal continues to be to expeditiously address and resolve incidents that impede progress towards a welcoming and inclusive campus community. Now, the irony of this statement apparently was lost on Huddleston and other campus diversity enforcers. Some students, it is safe to say, are to be more welcome and worthy of inclusion than others. The traumatization of the offending student resulting from this hysteria is unlikely to be addressed. Rather, we expect this student receive mandatory diversity and sensitivity training, followed by a public apology and confession of his thought crimes before being pressured to matriculate elsewhere. Unwelcomed, unwanted, a persona non grata, this young student is but one in a long list of casualties of the hatred and intolerance characteristic of Confederophobia, an epidemic that is sweeping America with new and increasingly outrageous manifestations. Was that how school was when y'all went? Me neither. All right, obviously I made up the word Confederophobia and I made this all up. But let me tell you how I got there, because I think it's interesting. It came from experience. I came up with the idea in the summer of 2015, a summer you all might remember, in the wake of the horrific and unprovoked murder of the mother Emmanuel parishioners at Charleston, South Carolina. I'd been asked by Leland Summers, the commander of the South Carolina Divisions of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, to be the media contact in the Midlands area, a job which at the time did not seem to, at least to me, to be much of an assignment at all. That was Sunday evening. The previous evening on Saturday, I attended an anti-flag rally, which seemed no different than any others that I'd been to over the several years. Leftover flower children, hipsters from the college, and a smattering of political activists and onlookers and concerned citizens. I really didn't think much about it. I went there to try to get a story for the newsletter, you know. Photographs of the Gum and Dillon roof with Confederate flags had surfaced, but I could neither see nor could I understand what one thing had to do with the other, or why people were equivocating the flags and the images of roof with the flag at the Confederate monument, the Confederate soldiers' monument, even knowing, as I did, the unwavering determination of some folks to see that the flag came down. There's been some allusions to the incident 2000, and that sort of background is important. I'm just going to put this on a side note and we'll get on with our business. For those that don't know, South Carolina had been under a tourism boycott by the NAACP since the compromise was reached in the South Carolina General Assembly in 2000. This compromise removed a similar flag from the dome of the state capitol building and placed a historically accurate flag at a historically significant place in order to make the flag's intended meaning completely clear. The flag was there to memorialize the South Carolina soldiers of the 1860s, not to protest the civil rights movement of the 1960s, a charge that was made ad nauseum for decades after the flag was erected on the dome of the state capitol to memorialize the centennial of the Civil War. That's how it got there. Like a dummy, I went to work on Monday and didn't think much about it, and I was wrong. My phone began to light up about 9:30 in the morning, and I left work at about noon to go down and do some interviews. I did interviews until about 7, and I figured that was about it. It was surreal, but it was not until the next day that things began to really heat up. Of course, there's far too many details to give a great detailed account of this time. However, let me say that the pressure was building and that by the third day, it felt as though a switch had flipped. It was no longer the same thing. You could feel the anger, and for the first time in my life, I did not feel safe in downtown Columbia. I quit doing interviews on the State House ground and would do them around, like, you know, Main Street or in a cafe or something like that, or over the telephone. I had a real personal existential crisis about that time, one that I'd never experienced before. Genuine fear. Fear for my safety, fear for my job, fear for my reputation, fear that I would be misunderstood by my friends and colleagues and damage valued relationship, particularly among my friends and colleagues of color. By the grace of God and the good counsel of my wife, I pulled through and fulfilled my duty, but that's another story for another time. It was a very important moment in my life. I had to push through it so that I wouldn't be afraid, because that's why most people don't speak out. What happened next changed the nature of the standoff, and mass hysteria began to sweep the land. After an 8,800% increase of Confederate-themed merchandise on Amazon, they were banned. They were one of many retailers that joined the purge, including Walmart, eBay, Sears, Kmart, Etsy, Spencer's, Target, Google Shopping, NASCAR, Overstock.com, Apple, and many, many others. Things then took a turn for the weird when Warner Brothers ended the production for the General Lee toy replica of the 1969 Dodge Charger from the 70s and 80s television show The Dukes of Hazzard. They would later cease licensing any Dukes project which featured the flag. Television stations soon began canceling reruns of The Dukes. Them good old boys who never meant no harm were done. Then came government bans. A special interest, at least to me, was the National Park Service, which banned the sale of standalone Confederate-themed merchandise at Civil War battlefields and other relevant locations. I was always under the impression that these battlefields had two opposing armies, and I'm pretty sure that in our lifetime there will be one army and then this thing over there that said, "That which shall not be named," or something. From flags to monuments to markers, the buildings, schools, parks, park bans began to take place at the state, local, and national level, indeed from sea to shining sea. To this day, the National Park Service continues this interdiction, and there's no sign that the purge will slow or stop. The madness, as you know, did not stop there. In the months that followed, things got even worse. The presidential race of 2016 threw gasoline on what, comparatively speaking, now looks more like a brush fire The portrayal of Trump supporters as racist, ignorant, uneducated bubbos was easily grafted upon the ongoing and increasing hostile narrative regarding the South. As the reality of the outcome of the presidential race began to sink in, things became not only more hysterical, but also more unpredictable and violent. Protests such as occurred at Berkeley, California in April of 2017 against Milo Yiannopoulos were an indication of where things would go. Were it not for his political views, Mr. Yiannopoulos would have been welcomed with open arms at Berkeley. Because if they were willing to riot, loot, and burn because they disagreed with the views of a flamboyant Jewish homosexual with a preference for black lovers, the radical response to the South was going to be ugly. For those paying attention, it should have come as no surprise when Antifa and other violent radicals made their way to New Orleans and from thence to Charlottesville, Memphis, and other destinations across Dixie. Built. So what is confederophobia? Confederophobia can be described as an irrational, pathological hatred and fear of all things Confederate. Flags, monuments, graves, portraits, trinkets, stickers, etc. Anything that could be associated even tenuously with the late Confederate States of America, including the region from which it sprang, and those people and groups of people who are native or sympathetic to this region. Regardless of the shape it assumes, Confederophobia has a general characteristic of dehumanizing self-identified Southerners and seeking to deny them their humanity, their dignity, and their right to exist as they are. As a result, many Southerners hide in the shadows, talk in whispers, for fear of being outed. It's not that they believe that being Southern is wrong. Rather, it's the fear of repercussion that they are likely to encounter if they dare act too Southern. Fear of being labeled a racist or white supremacist, for example, or being stigmatized in other ways that call their character and their reputation into question. Because of their naturally good disposition, attention to manners, and a desire to be left alone, self-identified Southerners are reluctant to make trouble, but the circumstances in which they find themselves are making this more and more difficult. Because of their strong attachment to family, which for them is intergenerational, attacks on Confederate symbols are personal. They are not ideological or political. Attacks on family members and attacks on their good name. The soldiers that have been memorialized in just about every city, town, hamlet, crossroads in the South are family. The name of our organization, Sons of Confederate Veterans, relates this fact. Even Southerners are not fully conscious of this fact or cannot fully articulate them, instinctively know that what is being done to them is wrong, and they resent it. The Confederophobe, unlike other people who suffer from phobias, does not view his thoughts, actions, and behavior as being abnormal. People with arachnophobia, for example, certainly hate spiders, fear them, but they don't blame the spiders for their malady. They know the phobia is the problem, that they and not the spiders or the people who like or at least tolerate spiders are what is out of whack. It's for this reason they seek treatment and not the extermination of spiders. Imagine if they did blame spiders, advocated for the extermination of spiders, were able to lobby public and private institutions or agitate in other ways to forward an anti-spider agenda. The very thought is silly. Unlike people suffering from confederophobia, they view their suffering from arachnophobia Do not see their reaction as virtuous, but rather for what it is, namely an irrational fear that can and should be overcome so that a normal, happy, and productive life can be pursued. If successful, the arachnophobe can learn to manage his fears and find a way to live in a world with spiders. They will probably not adopt a spider. They will probably not spend time watching spider documentaries on the National Geographic Channel. But they can certainly work towards finding a way to function and get along with the world as it is, spiders and all. That could be even more fearful if you got a human spider thing. Of course, Confederate phobes could do the same thing. They could learn to live in a world with self-identified Southerners and the traditional symbols and imagery and songs that they love. They could even learn to be friends with them. This cannot happen, however, if he fails to see that the problem is in his perception, not the persons or objects of offense that torment him. The Confederate phobe has an elaborate justification for his pathological hatred and fear. These justifications are ideological, abstracted from rationalist axioms, which impose on him moral obligations. Once fully internalized, the ideological template created onto which all particulars must conform. An example might be the axiomatic belief that Southerners are racist. If that is the case, then any and all particular Southerners, by definition, must also have this characteristic. It might sound something like the following, a syllogism. Southerners are racist. The author of Confederate phobia is Southern. Therefore, the author of Confederate phobia is racist. If one believes the first two statements, there is no alternative but to conclude that the third statement is true also. The construct of this belief is that any and all particular Southerners must be, as a logical necessity, have the universal characteristic of being racist, or you can choose any other characteristics or stereotypes that people use against the Southerners. If this is how you think, particular instances that seem to imply the existence of Southerners who do not have these characteristics must be lying or delusional, speaking in a secret code language perhaps, or if all else fails, are simply unaware of their racism and or other moral deformities that afflict them. While logically consistent, this position dehumanizes and objectifies Southern people, a scenario where nothing can count against his belief, not even his own experience, which isn't a good thing, by the way. Symbols are funny things. They point beyond themselves to something else. Of what this something else is a matter of interpretation. A symbol's meaning cannot be fixed by definition. It must be interpreted. If it could be objectively defined, it would cease to be a symbol, and it would become a sign. Getting potched. A red octagon with the word stop at an intersection is not open to interpretation. Neither is it a matter of opinion. It is also not the product of one's individual or collective experience. It means stop. You may not want to stop. You may not like stopping. You may even choose not to stop, but you know what the sign means, not just you, but all drivers. It's a sign. The Confederate battle flag, Confederate monuments, and other Southern cultural expressions can be interpreted as symbols of hate. But so what? Such is the nature of symbols. The question is not whether the same symbol can mean different things to different people. Experience clearly shows that they can. but whether one group should be able to dictate or fix the meaning of the symbol. It is for this reason slogans like Heritage Not Hate are counterproductive and give legitimacy to the false belief that symbols have one and only one meaning. By responding to the charge of hate, one is halfway to accepting the Confederophobic narrative. We have no business taking our cues from the SPLC and other kooks. The SCV is not racist. The SCV is not a hate group. Acknowledges the legitimacy of the concepts, which I, for one, seriously doubt. We are not a hate group. We should never use the language or conceptual framework of those people. It is a trap. It is a tar baby, if you will, which Br'er Rabbit learned, if you know the story, gets you more stuck the more you fight it. I only use the language and concepts in my book to show how ridiculous it is when you turn the linguistic and conceptual assumptions against themselves in an attempt to make a point. I don't believe in these concepts. They're Marxist concepts. I'm not a Marxist, so I've got no business using them. The problem, you see, is not the symbol, the thing in itself. The problem is in the mind of the thinker. The object hasn't the ability to offend. What one brings to the symbol determines how we interpret it and how it affects us. One has to be taught to interpret. Had one never seen a Confederate battle flag or even heard of the South, one would feel nothing upon coming across one for the first time. There would certainly be no importation of political or ideological baggage to color the response. We bring the meaning to the symbol alone. It is nothing but an inanimate object. One would not normally go to a rabbi or an imam or an atheist to understand Christianity or Christian symbols. They certainly have opinions and beliefs, indeed unique perspectives about the Christian faith and their symbols, but they are looking at it from the outside. For them, Christianity is not a living reality, but a topic of study. Likewise, you might not get the best interpretation on the institution of marriage if you went by visiting a woman's shelter. You will certainly learn about a particular kind of marriage and the kind of effects it can have in one's life, but these are exceptional cases. Certainly not marriage as it is for most people, or marriage as it is intended to be. Arguing from the hard case and choosing to maximize the significance of the aberration creates a skewed picture. There are bad Christians. There are bad marriages. There are bad people, including bad Southerners. This is not universal. This is particular. Confusing the particular with the universal often gives undue weight to the exception. Once this occurs, stereotypes and generalizations take the place of experience, observation, and normal deliberation. Try to talk to someone who's amped up about the flag, and you will see that none of those characteristics are present. You can't talk to them. Southern symbols mean to the Southerner exactly what they say they do. This does not mean that there cannot be alternative viewpoints, but rather that explanations do not, cannot speak for the people for whom Southern identity is a living reality. Outside the fold, those outside the fold are free to think whatever they want, believe whatever they want. But let us not pretend that the interpretations can be imposed upon the culture from which these symbols spring and the people that they represent. Who cares what they think? Their views might be interesting and in some cases informative, but they are not authoritative. And all the attempts to contextualize or take things down are people who are not participants in the culture. It's an abstraction to them. It's not an abstraction to us. It's personal. difference. Where's Chris? Time?
Good.
Oh, good. Well, I'm going to include one thing that wasn't in the original plan, mostly because I thought about it last night, and then this piece of paper was handed to me about the Confederados, so I thought it was providential. So I'm going to read a little something from my book, and then we're going to head on. I won't keep you much longer. What would the world look like without Confederophobia? I'm about to tell you. The curious case of the Confederado, quote, "The Confederate flag is a symbol of love," unquote. Bruno Luck, age 9. In the months leading up to the 2017 Summer Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, journalist Martin Rogers made a truly amazing discovery. In the city of Santa Barbara del Oeste, located about 335 miles west of the Games, the unthinkable is not only thinkable, but is openly and lovingly embraced. The Confederate flag, described by Rogers as, quote, "the most controversial symbol in American history," unquote, flies without criticism or controversy. In fact, it appears almost everywhere and on everything. Belt buckles, bumper stickers, children dress up in rebel uniforms. Confederate graves are lovingly attended to by the citizens and community gathers annually to celebrate their Confederate heritage. Their Confederate heritage. 2016, according to the article I had, marked the 150th anniversary of the arrival of the first Confederate settlers into this region. Ultimately, about 30 families relocated to plant cotton and other agricultural commodities after the war. The lure of inexpensive, fertile land, and to escape the chaotic inherent of the end of the war and the travails of Reconstruction, proved more than enough motivation for these former Confederates to strike out and start anew. The anniversary was a time to be commemorated with celebration. In a peaceful patch of leafy greenery next to a small chapel, near a graveyard where settlers and their descendants, Confederados as they're called, have been buried for generations. More than 2,000 people were expected to attend, including, gasp, Brazilians of color. Of course they are welcome. Catherine Townsend Luke said through an interpreter, "Welcome in the best way possible, like everyone, without distinction," unquote. In this alternative universe, Rogers astutely observed that there was no negative association with the flag that to many Americans see as a symbol of slavery and segregation. In fact, Rogers, despite his best efforts, I'm sure, could find no evidence of, quote, racism, unquote. Instead, noted Rogers, quote, "they are proud of their culture, and Confederate memories are regarded as an appreciation of their lineage, not a historical blight," unquote. In the words of Marco Sandalson, president of the Fraternidad de Ciencia Americana, sums up the problem as follows. The problem in America is not with the flag. The problem is with the people's mindset. We are sad to see brothers and sisters in the U.S. fight among each other and not respecting the right of one side to defend their heritage. This is the lesson that we here in Brazil have. They should overcome and reconcile and make peace with each other and respect the right of fellow Americans to look at the Confederate flag with love. Different people have different meanings. A good society is one that will respect them, unquote. In Brazil, Confederados do not suffer the ideological harassment and the political bullying that the American Confederados do in the United States. Even this American journalist, despite his greatest efforts, begrudgingly acknowledged that there was nothing nefarious or hateful in the Confederados' celebration of their history, heritage, and culture, including what he calls the most controversial symbol in American history, the Confederate flag, which is openly and proudly displayed as an emblem of their identity and a symbol of love in the Brazilian city. While the Brazilian Confederados provide a compelling counterexample to the shallow and uncharitable treatment of Southerners expressing their genuine affection for their history, heritage, and culture, I would not expect a reversal in the prevailing sentiment in the press. Your Confederate Memorial Day, dear reader, or dear listeners in this case, will not be covered with the same thoughtfulness and care. Brazilian Confederados can be taken at their word. American Confederados cannot. It is natural, normal, and healthy to embrace who and what you are. This is true for all people, including Southerners. Unless taught otherwise, the Southerner has no reason to think that his genteel and easygoing ways are offensive, or that his forebears were racist, or that his cultural heritage is an affront to common decency. It would certainly never occur to him that he should purposely abandon his own cultural peculiarities for those of another. Many people seem to believe that one can just move on from being Southern. That if these rednecks were just properly educated and taught the error of their ways, they could become real Americans. To be Southern is not a choice. Although the rejection of one's natural culture and biological condition is. The rejection of one's Southern identity, whether by suppression or repression, often occurs after long-term exposure to Confederophobic ideas and ideological constructs that are brought in from the outside. Although much of this occurs in the various forms of media, television, news, entertainment, etc., the real psychological damage is done in the classrooms. Confederophobia is carefully inserted through mandatory attendance of public or government-licensed private K-12 schools before its full fury is thrust upon students in so-called higher institutions of learning. Many a young Southern boy and girl can get through the former mostly unscathed. Very few make it through the latter intact. Many a Southern has become a Confederophobe and actively persecutes those who openly express what he inwardly represses. This kind of reconstructed Southerner will typically chronicle his Southern bona fides before apologizing for slavery, calling his ancestors traitors, and throwing his kith and kin under the proverbial bus. He knows, and will tell anyone who will listen, that the South was evil, the Confederacy was racist, and that he has seen the light even though he never owned a slave, picked up a gun to fight an invading army, or knew anyone who did. Such a person does violence not only to his people, but unto his own soul. They are the worst sort of Confederophobes because they are what they claim to hate. It eats them from the inside out. If these Southern tendencies ever begin to resurface, the self-loathing Southerner is forced to either come out or conscientiously live a lie. Neither path is fun, and both are fraught with scary and dangerous. Both paths are scary and fraught with their own dangers. You can suppress your Southern tendencies, but you can never be a Californian, a Bostonian, a New Yorker, or God forbid, a milquetoast American. You can only be a Southerner in denial, a Southerner fighting against his nature, a social experiment, a victim of Stockholm Syndrome. You can try to cover it up, tamp it down, burn it, bury it, have it exercised, or if all else fails, give yourself over with reckless abandonment to the American educational system, but sooner or later it will resurface. Not because it is Southern, but because it is true. I would like to conclude my remarks by reading the final chapter of Confederophobia called Coming Out, It is a reclamation called to cast off shackles of shame to those Southerners who are afraid. Lucky for you, I don't write long chapters, so we're almost done. Being a self-identified Southerner is not the problem. Oh, this isn't it. Here it is. If you are a victim of Confederate phobia, you are not alone. For most people, it takes time to truly come to understand who and what you are. It's okay to be confused or to be uncertain about whether or how you should come out and live openly and proudly as a Southerner, to be who and what you are, to stand tall without apology or shame for your legitimate and praiseworthy history, heritage, and culture. Education will be a vital part of your recovery as you move from victim to victor. There are many lies your teacher told you, many falsehoods that will need to be addressed. As you become more versed in the true history of the South, your confidence will increase and your fear will decrease. There are many Southern-friendly resources and organizations out there that can help you along. I will be providing some resources in the appendices, which I did. There is an amazing journey waiting for you should you choose to begin the process of reclaiming your identity and thereby reclaiming your life. When you are ready to step from the shadows of self-loathing and shame and embrace your Southern identity, we'll be waiting to receive you with open arms, to join in our struggle as we take our stand against those who insult us because they are insulted, hate us because they accuse us of hate, and deny us our God-given right to exist openly and without fear as a distinct people. Be brave, be strong, and be true, dear Southerner. You are not alone. I would like to thank you all for allowing me to speak today. And if you're interested in this, I'm selling it for $5. I've got another book for $5. I know the boss, and he said I could sell them for cheap. In conclusion, I thank you for your time and attention, and may God bless the South. Now let me get unhooked from this thing.
Thank you, Paul. Our next speaker is going to be Ryan Walters, and we'll take just about a quick 5-minute break. It's just a few minutes before 2 o'clock, and we'll restart at 2:05.